Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're going to jump into a conversation about the latest in the Trayvon Martin case. Of course, George Zimmerman is now free. He's on bail, and he's out there in another state with a bracelet around his ankle, what that means. And also, this is the beginning of the case that caused so much controversy in Baltimore with Shomrim. The Wertheim brothers are on trial, and we'll talk about all that and the connections between the two, which is one of the reasons that the defense team wants the trial delayed. So we'll talk about all that and more, but first I have to remind you, this is going to be really good. The WEAA invites you to the opening reception of the Sam Wallace Jamaican Folk Art Pottery and Modern Technique this Saturday, April 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. right here at our WEAA studios. There'll be a gallery talk at 5 p.m. Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell are the curators. Once again, they do a great job. The exhibition runs through the end of May. For more information, you can call 443-885-3564 or go to weaa.org. And it's sponsored in part by the DMV REI United. Okay, so we're here in studio with Doc Cheatham, who is Doc. This is not what's your new title, man?
I'm the new president of the Greater Baltimore chapter of the National Action Network.
Why can't I keep that
Sharpton keep is our president and founder.
Right, exactly. Thank you, brother.
I'm sorry. Third civil rights group.
That's right. You're the only man who's been head of every civil rights group you could be head of in the city of Baltimore. And the Reverend Heber Brown joins us, pastor of the Blessed and Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore, blogs at faithandactiononline.com, and is a minister of a church around Belvedere Square. Where Pleasant Hope is. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Honored
Thank
to
you,
be
Mark.
Here.
Lines are open at 410-319-8888. And since we were going to do this is a last-minute thing this morning to book this show that we put in here and push the other two shows back a little bit because we think it's important. It happened because both not just George Zimmerman getting out of jail, but because the case of the Wertheim brothers is launched in Baltimore, the Shomrim case. And we did reach out to folks from the Jewish community as well. We wanted to bring them in. We did it last minute. Couldn't get all the people we wanted, but they will be coming in to talk about this. One of those folks who I talked to today, who really wants in on this conversation, is an editor of the Washington Jewish Week who wrote an article about this case. And he couldn't come in because he has to testify tomorrow. But in the article that he wrote, Phil Jacobs wrote was an article that he said that there was no justification for anybody stopping any young person in the city walking during daytime hours. Why should that be? But let's talk about what's going on here. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. One of the things that I wanted to – let me just put this way first. Let's talk about Baltimore first, then go to Trayvon. One of the things that I want to say and ask the mayor about tomorrow, one of the questions I'll ask her, and if they're listening, they'll know that's fine. is that in this case that with the Wertheim brothers, it took place with Shomrim. No matter how you feel about the case, and I'm not asking her or anybody else to take their position on the case, who's a public official, but two things. A, do we not have to come to grips with the reality that there is a divide, and I think a serious divide, of mistrust, dislike, not knowing between especially the Orthodox Jewish community and the African-American community live together in that Park Heights neighborhood. Let me just stop there. We'll go to number two in a minute. Do you think that rift exists? And if it does, what do you two gentlemen think you do about it?
Well, I'll first say talk on behalf of the civil rights community. I'm not one of those civil rights leaders who's going along to get along. There is a divide. But I feel at the same time I hasten to say that there is an urgent necessity for us to have more dialogue, for us to come together. But I know some groups, they work for certain folks and they get funding from certain organizations and, you know, they're going to say what's political and what's appropriate. For an individual who goes up in the area on a regular basis, there's a divide. But I hasten to say there's an urgent necessity for us to come together.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, the divide is, for me, as plain as day, is plain as standing at the corner of Northern Parkway and Park Heights and looking left and looking right. And you see even geographically there's a divide. There's as you say, misunderstandings. There's not knowing, et cetera, et cetera. But we can't pretend as if it's not there. We gotta voice that and say, yeah, there's some issues there.
I mean, there are. Let me again put something else on the table here with that and getting – throw it a little deeper. in our own community here in Baltimore, again, before we talk about Trayvon Martin and what is going on with that case, is that I've heard racist statements coming out of the Jewish community, without a doubt. I've also heard a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment coming out of the black community. That's what I mean. I mean, it gets, and it, you hear it in your churches, you hear it in your synagogues, you hear it in people's community centers, in people's homes. I mean, that's where I want to get down to the best. That's what, and it does exist. And I think that's something that we have to confront and stop kind of playing that everybody loves each other. And there are some great groups in town, like the Blues, that I used to be part of, the Blacks and Jews, this group that used to get together. But they're all made up of people who are most of them were good liberal folks who all like each other. But that's not the reality of the world that we're facing.
I saw as an outsider, was never invited in. Maybe I was too vocal or too militant. I always viewed the Blues group as a group who found commonality in things that were easy. But I don't think that's how we solve problems. I don't think that's how we really address the real issues. I think we have to put the truth out on the table and find the best way to deal with it. You know, we have one of the groups I belong to actually has a meeting up in the Jewish area. And, you know, I get kind of frustrated when I see buses just going through every block in the neighborhood. And I come in, I walk four blocks down the street into Lower Park Heights, and I don't see buses just riding through every block. And I'm saying, well,
what do you mean buses riding through every block? What do you mean?
Physical buses, MTA buses.
Oh.
You know, we go on buses in Lower Park Heights. You walk three or four blocks to get to a bus. Where we have meetings at, the buses ride down every street, MTA buses. How do you get MTA buses? I went to a community meeting some years ago. There were some serious problems. And we found out that certain parts of Upper Park Heights had almost individual police for every two or three blocks. When we have hard times getting community police to deal with community organizations, not just blocks. And they admitted it in the community. Oh, yes, this is Officer such and such. He covers the 1800 and the 1900 block. You know, like they were individual police officers. I'm saying it needs to be addressed. And I think issues such as how we vote, we need to put that on the table. We need to put it on the table and say, listen, let's deal with the hard issues. We'll come away better at the end of the day. But if we keep soft-shoeing these issues, the issues get worse rather than better from my vantage point.
I've never heard of the MTA or the police thing. That's interesting. The first time I've ever heard that.
I agree. I definitely agree with Doc on the issue of getting together. And I'm working on an article. I'm going to write this article one day. It's called Don't Rush to Kumbaya. And I think there's this sometimes this push and drive to say, come on, let's just sing together and like each other and hold hands and act like everything's all right. But I think, you know, as has been said, we got to deal with the very, very real issues, systemic issues. What Doc just raised was a systemic issue, quality of life issues, issues that ultimately boil down to money and resource. And we got to have those conversations. But I think we also have to be mindful about how we have the conversation. Because you can put a whole bunch of people around the table, but if power is concentrated in one side of the table, then the dynamics of the dialogue is going to be impacted because there's going to be some people around the table who are not free to speak, or if they do speak, there's no power behind what they're saying. And so I think about how do we have the conversation in such a way that the playing field is level. That might mean there needs to be some work done in the black community about
right.
strengthening and supporting our own institutions and coming and strengthening ourselves. So when we sit down, we really can sit down eye to eye. I think sometimes I feel like sometimes when different groups come together to sit at one table, it's almost like one group is sitting at adult chairs and other group is sitting at baby chairs. So we're at the same table, but we're not seeing eye to eye because we don't.
I felt that actually happened as a result of the Sumrin issue. The communities were brought together, but they were brought into the community. The Jewish community. Why was it not brought in a neutral community? You know, that you had individuals that were invited to the meeting, to me, really didn't represent us. They didn't represent the hardcore feelings. They represented the groups and organizations that were going to go along to get along, but that wasn't, to me, how you were going to resolve the issue. And that's why I think we're still where we are today with Shamrim.
But
we really didn't discuss Shamrim with that meeting that was held what is it? Probably, golly, it's been almost a year and a half ago. It's been that long ago. But there was a meeting between the African-American community, the Jewish community.
And where was
there
the
were
meeting
some
held?
African-American leaders that were there. But they didn't represent the hardcore feelings about what happened.
Where was the meeting held?
God. It was one of the Jewish centers. And you end up having some folks end up walking out on that particular meeting, we were told.
I didn't
see credence in that meeting.
The argument can be made that the meeting should have been held where the incident took place. I mean, because that community is a mixed community.
That's correct.
I mean, it's a community that is Jewish, Orthodox Jewish, and Reform and secular Jewish. They all live in that community together, along with African Americans, Caribbean Americans, a lot of Latinos live in that community now. I mean, it's a very mixed community in many ways. I mean, so it seems to me that it makes some sense to have a discussion in the community where it took place. But one of the things I would like to know from the mayor is if the police commissioner is if we're going to have neighborhood watch groups in neighborhoods like that, then should the neighborhood watch groups have to represent every community member in it? In other words, we're going to have a Latino group and a black watch group and an Orthodox Jewish watch group, and shouldn't there just be, if there's a group there to help deal with crime and help the sheep do safe and work for the community, shouldn't they be a mixed group of people who represent the people in that community?
Well, I think that's one question to explore, and I think another question really or another area of research and study that needs to be had also is to investigate the relationship between Shamrim and the Baltimore City Police Department. They have a financial relationship where the group raises, I think a few years ago they raised about $15,000 for the Baltimore City Police Department, and I believe that's an annual thing they do. There's competition between Shamrim and Baltimore City Police, and they raise money as a fundraiser for them. They have relationships with sitting judges. They have relationships with elected officials. And so this is not, from everything that I've seen, Mark, this is not just some regular community watch group, just some neighbors getting together. This is really, the Shamrim is a national group. This is a local chapter of that group. And they have some major money, some major political clout behind them. And I just want to make sure the rules aren't different because they have that financial relationship and those connections with judges and elected officials.
I was going to get to the phones here.
I looked at an issue, Mark and Reverend Brown, where I did not hear the police, nor did I hear our elected leadership, starting with the mayor, speak out on this issue. And I saw six very glaring issues. One, and this comes from neighborhood watch programs all over the country. All of them have almost some of the similar things that I found. One, that you don't take the law into your own hands. Two is you don't approach suspicious people. Three is you don't stop criminals that are committing crimes. Four is you don't pull them over or cars over when you're on your patrol. You don't take unnecessary risks to obtain information from these people. And you don't hesitate to call the police. Now, I found these in about eight different neighborhood watch programs all over the country. All of these were violated, not only in the Zimmerman case, but in the Shamrim case. But one of the first things we heard from the elected officials in the police department, this was a good group. They did everything by the book.
Right.
So we start finding out what actually happened. And, of course, it's all alleged at this point. It's going to court. But these are just some of the similarities I found in the two violations in both cases, that some of the fundamental things of a watch program were violated. And in both cases, because of the relationship that the individuals had with the police, as to why it wasn't handled appropriately.
Let me open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to, Adam, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? My name's Adam. I actually work a lot with Reverend Brown and Doc Cheatham on this issue when it initially came up. And one of the problems that we ran into as a collective, one of the things that Doc mentioned, was those meetings that were happening, you know, because of the incident that happened. And what I noticed as a young person, I'm only 24, is that, you know, there were a lot of racial dynamics that just kind of exploded out of nowhere. And I think that's kind of what's going on in Baltimore, is that we're not being honest about some of the very explosive racial dynamics that happen in Baltimore City. I mean, like Reverend Brown said, you know, you can go at Northern Parkway and see the difference. You can look left and right and see the clear economic and racial disparities that exist and the differences that exist. We're not talking about them in Baltimore. And I'm actually kind of intrigued because I don't think this would have came up again if it wasn't for the Trayvon Martin case. And then now we're getting around to just talking about it again, because as a young person, it was really discouraging to see if people that were older than me, you know, that were really getting caught up in the emotion of it and getting caught up in the racial explosiveness of it without creating a concrete strategy to address it. And in Baltimore, it's weird because, you know, although we're a majority black city, there's all these racial dynamics that exist that don't get addressed. And I think it affects us in the long term when we're trying to address the issues on a more global scale.
I kind of think it probably would have jumped up just because the case was so huge when it happened, and it just went to court today.
Yeah, I think that it came back up because it was in court. I think that people only paid attention again because of the Trayvon Martin case. I suspect, this has just been my experience, is that if it was not for the Trayvon Martin incident, I mean, you know, it would have been mentioned in the Baltimore Sun once or twice, and maybe people have been talking about it. Maybe folks would have been, you know, protesting and what have you. But I believe that most people wouldn't be paying attention to it.
I think you have a point. Yeah, that's very possible.
How many postponements has it been? I mean, it's postponement after postponement.
Six postponements.
Right. And even today, the defense counsel was trying to get another postponement. Right.
but again, in all fairness, how the court system goes, I have to throw this in. I mean, 4 to 6, 7 postponements is not unusual in city cases. And that happens in lots of cases. Prosecution does it. Defense does it. I mean, I don't think it's because of a showroom. I mean, that is the way this court system works, and that's what legal attorneys do. They put stuff off and off and off as much as they can. I mean, I don't see that as something that is unlike other cases that I've seen that have nothing to do with white or black.
I would definitely agree, but I would also then put on the table justice delayed is justice denied. And in this particular case, something did in fact happen. The attempt is now again being made to delay this again. We want another venue. We want this case delayed because there's too much exposure on the Zimmerman case. Well, how long do you want to delay this? At what point do we actually address this issue? I will hasten to say this. I want the prosecution to do its best job. I want the defense to do its best job. I want a good jury to hear and very clearly listen to the evidence or the lack of evidence and for them to make an intelligent decision and that justice be served. But justice delayed is justice denied. And for us to consider another postponement is only going to anger the community.
We have to take a break. We're going to come right back. We will go to our other callers. Grace is on the line, and Stephen and Leo and lots of people. So we're right back. 410-319-8888. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. The number is 1-800-638-7781. If you're a first or second time home buyer, there could be a house that you can afford in Baltimore City. 1-800-638-7781. Back here with Doc Cheatham and Reverend Heber Brown, and picking up where we left off, we can go right to the phones, or should we go right to the phones? Let's do that. And let's go to Leo. You're on the air. Leo, you're on the air. Leo, you there?
Yes. Good evening. Mark Steiner.
Hi, Leo. Welcome.
And how are all of you?
Well,
okay, I know all of you.
You do.
Look, let me tell you. August 24th of 2011, Greg Bernstein, the state's attorney, was here in my senior citizen building, Memorial Apartments in Bolton Hill, for a meeting of the Central Police Community Relations Commission Council. And I asked him very pointedly about the Sham Rim case in terms of why he elected to drop the charges from a felony. Patricia Jessamy had charged these guys with a felony. for bus cracking this guy's head and breaking his hand, breaking his
wrist.
His wrist. And the state's attorney could not give me a definitive answer other than he felt it should not have been such. They should not have been charged with a felony. They had no prior record, all of that jazz. That was a bunch of foolishness. I'm looking at the police department walkie-talkie was used to bang this 15-year-old boy in the head. That was a police department walkie-talkie. Now they want to change a venue. Where do they want to move it? To Florida or to Israel? You know, postponements. I heard what you said, Mark. They're going to play this game with these postponements. But justice delayed is, in fact, justice denied. And this issue is not going to go away. They claim that it's so inflammatory that they want to wait until after the Trayvon Martin case is adjudicated before they process and move ahead with the Wertesheim case here in Baltimore. Such a ridiculous logic at best. Very nonsensical from the point of view of those of us who say, no justice, no peace. So where are we? Are we going to be given a fair shake? I know the Greater Baltimore Committee is controlled and run by the Jewish community. The Greater Baltimore Committee, which all of the media are a part of in this area, and most of the big businesses seem to want to keep the lid on. Well, I want to keep it on, but I believe in self-defense and I believe in justice.
And I'm
and we're not getting it.
Okay. Let me just a couple things. I'll let my panel jump in here. If they had not postponed the case, it wouldn't have any connection with Trayvon Martin because it had been done before that case ever happened.
That's right.
It had been done and over with.
That's right.
So we would have had justice by now one way or the other. We didn't know what would have happened. And I think that, I'm going to go out on a limb myself here. People can throw stones at me if they want to, but let me throw them out there. It doesn't, I think, help things when you say, do they want the case transferred to Israel? That's like, to me, a statement that pushes the envelope closer to anti-Jewish sentiment, which doesn't help us deal with it. These guys are guilty of a crime against a young black man. They need to deal with the crime they were guilty of. I think those kind of comments don't help us. I'm going to say that, A. And B, I think it fuels also anti-Semitic sentiment when you talk about the GBC being controlled by Jews, which it is not. People who own Constellation Energy, the Bank of America, Wachovia, and all the other banks that are the big players in GBC are not run by anybody in the Jewish community. I mean, I think that doesn't take us where we need to go. I think we need to do the facts of what it means. But this case was about racial profiling, about people stopping a black teenager in a community because he was walking through in a community where everybody has a right to walk where they want, whether black folks live there or not. But they do. And that we have to deal with the fact of whether or not there should be ethnically driven groups that police patrol, that patrol our communities. I think no. Put that out there. You all can comment back.
I think that with Brother Leo's...
And I know Brother Leo, too. We went to jail together in the early 60s. We were in the civil rights movement together. I know Leo very well, and I love Leo, so I'm just putting it out there.
I think to his point about the Jews run the GBC piece, I would think that underneath that is a concern about the level of influence that, for example, when I say the Shamrim has relationships with the Baltimore City Police Department, that's documented. That there's a financial relationship there. When I say that they have a relationship with sitting judges, documented, elected officials, documented. And I think the concern is what happens when you reach that level of influence and connection with political and economic power. The concern is that the rules can change because of the level of those relationships and those connections. So I think underneath that, I mean, I think that's the driving motivator behind those type of comments. It's like, what is really going on here? Why is it in Baltimore media? Why is it? That's a part of the hard conversation, Mark, that you were talking about earlier, that needs to be had. Let's explore these relationships. And we would do that for any other group. We would do that for any other people group, any other organization. How are those relationships in play? And how might they be used, even if it's unintended, how might it create an unlevel playing field for everybody in the city of Baltimore?
And remember, Doc, years back, that we argued around the issue of whether the NOI should be allowed to patrol housing projects
And probably all the organizations, they did the best job.
Right.
Without a doubt.
But we ran them out.
No, not we.
We meaning the government.
The government, that's
ran them
correct.
Out.
Okay, we agree.
We are the people, so it is our government, whether we like what they're doing
that's
or not.
That's right. We had to take them whether we want them or not.
So anyway, you were going to say, then we'll go back to the phones.
There are some great similarities. I looked at and I was able to discern at least eight between the Zimmerman case and the Schumerin case. Both cases, the accused is alleging self-defense. Both cases, there's the question of racial profiling. Both cases, the question of neighborhood watch vigilantes is in the forefront. Both cases had the alleged individuals leaving their automobiles, yet they were supposedly trained to do the opposite. Both instances have the alleged perpetrators purportedly confronting the individuals, which is also against their guidelines. They are not to confront the individuals. Both cases seemingly show a slow development in either preferential treatment by the police department or questionable actions by the police department. The Schumerin case showed a 10-day arrest period, and then the other one showed a 46-day arrest period. Both showed that the police evidently didn't follow their procedures or they gave preferential treatment. Both cases have deadly weapons being used by a group that's not supposed to have weapons at all. And the other one is that the neighborhood watch groups have a responsibility to report a crime. And in both cases, neither did such. You know, what I found is instance after instance, there are similarities. But the similarities show me very clearly that two different sections were supposed to have been trained properly trained as to what to do and not to do, and they violated all of them. But then we got people rushing to judgment. I'm not rushing to judgment. I want to see a good trial. But, you know, you got elected officials and police departments not doing what they should do, and we got elected officials immediately coming to their defense. And sadly enough, we got black individuals and organizations immediately coming to say, oh, come by, yeah, it's time for us to come together. No, it was time for us to sit down and have a serious discussion about what had happened.
And that's the question. I mean, why that? You know, and back to my point earlier, when you talk about the elected officials and others who are saying, no, this is a good group and all this other stuff, and we have a historic relationship with the black community and all that is good, but we're just talking about justice. Why is it that, you know, there was this united effort almost to stand and say, no,
I agree, Reverend.
You know what I mean? And that's why I say, if there's money changing hands, perhaps. Now, if I'm wrong, prove me wrong. But at least let's put it on the table and say and explore why is it that in this particular case, when three grown men attack a black teenager in the Park Heights community, why is it that there was more energy behind defending Schumerin as opposed to standing up for this black teen amongst different sections of the city?
First of all, let me get back to the phones here. We're going to do a whole hour on this or more because I understand what you're saying, and I think that there are. I want to get right. Grace, you're coming up next, so hold on. We're going to come to your phone call in Waverly. The money changing hands thing about the raising the money. I'm not so sure that I would think that $15,000 is going to influence the police do or not.
But that was 1 year.
That was one year. But I think that the relationship between the local police in that district and groups like Schumerin is a real issue, you know. And I think that, look, if we can put it on the table, what I would put on the table here is that there is in the Orthodox Jewish community a powerful political force.
No doubt about it.
It resonates in this town. And so, you know, as there are in other communities, but that is a force that resonates. And so, you know, when Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake or anybody runs for mayor or president of city council, folks in Lower Park Heights don't vote. Don't vote. Folks in northern Baltimore, whether it's Park Heights or Roland Park or even Waverly or Charles Village and other places that are more racially integrated, do vote. And so where that's where attention is paid.
And that's a sad commentary.
I'm just talking about the reality of what goes through an elected official's mind.
Your leadership and your support for community should be based on need, desire, what is best for the community. Shouldn't matter whether or not one person votes. You should be representing the individuals and what is in the best interest of your community and your community. I'm one who has registered more voters than anyone in the state of Maryland, and I do all that I can to get folks to vote and educate them on voting. But if I were an elected official, I don't necessarily need my community to tell me that I need to do the right thing.
But
I need to do the right thing regardless.
Yeah, I think it's also important, though. I mean, that was a pretty big brush mark in terms of, you know, Lower Park Heights not voting. I think it's a pretty big brush. But I think it's also different ways that a politician might look at who they would give attention to. I would be curious to do some type of research on where political contributions are coming from by zip code. And see how – let's look at that. Let's look at politicians and put a graph over time over the financial contributions to a politician and where what communities get the most attention.
That's easy to do.
And if there's poor black people who can't put a dollar or two or three or hundreds in a political campaign, politicians are creatures of self-preservation. They're going to go and pay attention to the people who can keep them in office and keep them moving forward. And that's just – I mean, that's the reality. I mean, it may not be the what's taught in civic class in Baltimore City public schools, but the reality is – the squeaky wheels with the money wheels get attention.
So we have a lot of people calling in. Let's try to get a few more calls, and we'll have to switch gears and talk about what's happening to our tax dollars in Annapolis and what the gambling interests are doing or not doing in Annapolis to the budget. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Grace, you're on the air, as I promised. Grace, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you doing, Mark?
Very well. Welcome.
Good. Good. Reverend Brown.
Peace, Sister Grace.
Good, good. Well, first, I wanted to say that I'm really glad you're doing the segment on this because awareness is something that's very important. As some of the previous callers have said, it's an issue that happens all the time, but now it's kind of coming to the forefront. Primary example would be, despite the overwhelming parallels between these two cases, thousands of people came out to demonstrate for the Trayvon Martin case, yet there was a minimal involvement in the Chamberlain demonstration here locally. So we definitely need to get more people involved on local issues as well as national issues. Like I said, your Trayvon case just happened to become national, so more people were aware. But we definitely need to be more aware of what's going on right here at home. As a matter of fact, speaking of which, I actually participated in that march on the 26th, the Justice for Trayvon March and Rally, that took place on the 26th. I think it went from Inner Harbor to City Hall, and I also volunteered on that demonstration. So I know firsthand that Reverend C.D. Witherspoon of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was a principal organizer of that march, along with All People's Congress, who are also the leading organization fighting against racism and police brutality, including working on the demonstrations regarding the Chamberlain case. And I'm just wondering, of course, with all due respect to your guests, I was wondering, because there's only so much time in a radio show, did you plan on doing like an interview or anything like that with the main organizers of that rally at any point in time? I'd be interested to hear their opinions on these cases and issues as well.
We might. I mean, I don't know. We are going to have lots of different guests on the show. We'll probably have them as well. I mean, I'm not going to make commitments on who I'll have on the air now or not, but I mean, we're going to have lots of different organizations on. We've had them in the past.
Right.
So yeah, but there were a lot of people who say they organized that rally downtown. There was a lot of mess in the beginning of that rally, trying to figure out who actually was running the rally. But
I actually volunteered. I with my own bare hands, I put those signs together, so I know exactly who was behind the whole operation of it. And there's definitely C.D. Witherspoon and All People's Congress.
All right.
But so that's why I'm saying I think they would probably know, have a lot of opinions on this as well. But I'm so, again, like I said, I'm so glad that you're doing a segment on this and that we're keeping it alive because I didn't want the awareness to go down as soon as Zimmerman, you know, was charged and things like that. I didn't want people to lose interest in it. And we need to keep people aware of what's going on step by step until, you know, justice is served.
Thank you, Grace. We've had a lot of shows around the Trayvon Martin case since the beginning of this. And we'll continue looking around the country as well. Let's try to get one more caller in here before we have to switch gears and get to our other two guests who we need to call out to and bring them on. Andrea, you're on the air.
Good evening, everybody.
Hi, Andrea. Welcome.
I was just calling simply because my 8-year-old son had made a comment, and then he chickened out and got scared to make his comment. So I'll make it
it's
for
right.
him.
It's okay.
Oh, he's full of comments when we're not on the phone.
Well, that's okay.
But he did make a mention about the case. He was just like, well, Mom, if they keep delaying it, then the witnesses won't show up, and then they won't have a trial. And, you know, I agree with him wholeheartedly. If they keep delaying this trial, then, of course, you know, like your key witnesses, over time, they move, people, you know, they have life changes. So I think that, you know, once again, I'm not trying to feed into the conspiracy theories or things like that, but it does make you question and scratch your head, you know, like, really, what is going on? And then my son, he's sitting here mad at me now, but he did comment. He's like, Mom, they need a new mayor. And he's like, by the way, did you know that this governor here is the most powerful governor in the country? Something is wrong with that. He's like, if I can figure it out, and I'm only 8, how come the rest of the state can't figure it out? And I agree with him. Like, I agree with everyone, whether you're talking about these strange relationships. I mean, it's just so obvious and blatant. I mean, when you brought up the issue of people not voting, I mean, if I was in political office, I'm going to be honest. I mean, I vote everywhere I live. But I wouldn't be concerned if people vote or not, because as you can see, the turnout gets lower and lower. These, some of the same people have
right.
been in office for as probably as old as I am, and I'm 40 years old. So it's like, you know, what do you do? And even if, and if my kids can see this, and like I said, my son is 8, then it kind of really makes brings into question, what can we do? Because obviously something needs to change.
Yeah, and I just, let me be clear that when I was talking about the voting, I wasn't saying that this is an excuse nor reason or justification or anything. I'm just saying this, that there are a lot of complex reasons why that what happens. And look, race is a big part of what happens here. You know, race and class. If you go off and do something in an upper class neighborhood, the response is going to be different than if you do it in a working class, middle class neighborhood. That's the reality. And race has a big part to play in that. So that's a big piece of this. I don't think these witnesses are going anywhere. Because they're not so much witnesses. As I said, one of the people we want to get in the show, somebody who wrote in one of the Jewish newspapers about the case, saying there was no excuse for this attack, that anybody has a right to walk in the neighborhood doing at any time they want to. There's no reason to stop another human being like that, whether he was wearing a hoodie, as he put it in his piece, or not. And he's testifying tomorrow, and we'll be a guest on the show to talk about that once his testimony is over. So, I mean, I think these folks aren't going anywhere, and we're going to come back to this case. We're following it during the course of this week. We'll see what happens in the first couple of days of the trial. And we'll come back to it later in the week, and we'll come back to it next week, as we will with Trayvon Martin. I want to thank my good friends, Doc Cheatham and Reverend Heber Brown, for being in the studio with us. Thank you so much for taking time to come in for our listeners.
It was an honor, my friend.
Good to have you all here. And we're going to come right back and take a look at what's happening or not happening in Annapolis. Stay with us.